Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 557 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in
Chantilly,
Virginia. And I'm here with our main man, Micah.
Hey, Max, it is so great to be with you. It's so wonderful to see you. And here we are. We've been doing this down here for 12 years, and I think I've been coming down for six? I can't remember.
I think we've been here for 8 years. The podcast is 11 years old, but we've been coming here for 8 years.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And this is, I can't remember how many years, but it's... What a wonderful event.
They keep asking us back.
We must be doing something right.
I'm also here with Robert Fairbairn. You might know him from the Airline Pilot Guy podcast.
I think I've popped up there a couple of times. Hi, everybody. Robert, really thrilled to be here in one of my favorite places at the Udvar-Hazy Center here, which I'm fortunate enough to live near and get to come and show people around on a fairly regular basis. And I'm sorry that David wasn't able to make it today. It's a shame, yes. Happy to jump in and spend a little time behind this this mic.
And that's something that I wanted to say. This is, when we talked about it earlier, on a few weeks ago, you and I, Max, this is the happiest day of the year for me. Yeah, there's Christmas. Yeah, there's Thanksgiving. There's all sorts of other things, but Innovations in Flight is the happiest day of the year for me, and it's so great to see you because I get to be with my Airplane Geeks family. But today is also kind of a sad day because it's the first Innovations in Flight that I've been to without David, who is not feeling very well and miss him so badly. And we didn't know until last night that he wasn't coming.
Yes, it's not exactly the same without David here. That's for sure. So we all wish him well and hope he can recover his health as quickly as possible. But we should talk about the event. I know many Airplane Geeks listeners are very familiar with this because we come every year and we talk about it every year. But this is the Innovations in Flight Family Day and Outdoor Aviation Display. And it's always the Saturday before Father's Day, that weekend. And what they do is they open the museum, as they always do. But there are some added activities, one of which is to have some exhibitors in the museum sprinkled around different locations in the museum. And Airplane Geeks Podcast is one of them. There are many others here, and we'll be talking with some of them later in the podcast, later in this episode, so you can look forward to that. But they also fly in kind of a wide collection of different aircraft, and those are on display outside. We're adjacent to the Dulles Airport, and they have a taxiway, so they can actually come over from the airport.
And I got a chance to take a quick look outside, and among other aircraft, there's an MV-22, a Marine Osprey. There's a C-17. There's a P-8, and there's an F-22.
Wow! And we have some friends out there as well. Hillel flew his plane in with his son.
And that's a pipe. What?
It's a PA-28. I think it's a Cherokee 180, technically, the version he has.
Yeah, I think it's a 1972.
That sounds
aircraft.
About right. It's a PA-28 180, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. He flew in yesterday. I actually picked him and his son up at Jet Aviation, one of the FBOs here, and brought them to the hotel. So they're out there, and we might have some other friends out there too. Jonathan
Dispatcher
Barron.
Dispatcher Mike came in his Musketeer.
That's right.
Up from Atlanta.
That's right. Jonathan Barron might have the Shark out. I know he was planning to attend last year, but couldn't. I'm hopeful that he's out there and we'll catch him too.
Yeah, I know there are some interesting aircraft out there. I don't know what all of them are yet, but I know we have a sampling of some unusual stuff.
So, Robert, tell us a little bit about you, your background, and your flying activities.
Well, from the flying standpoint, I'm a private pilot. I've been working on instrument and commercial for some time here, but mostly it's a hobby. May turn into a job at some point. You never quite know, but I like to learn and pick up new stuff. So I've been flying for, I guess, about 4 years now. I'm based here in the DC area, only about half an hour from where we are. So I've been fortunate enough to pop onto a couple of podcast episodes on the Airline Pilot Guy show when their various hosts were here in town, and have enjoyed that immensely. Besides that, my background's in actually audiovisual engineering and physics, and so I've worked in that industry a bit, done some broadcast work, done some production and design work, and these days I'm a commercial photographer for a living. So,
and we put some of the audio skills you have to work this morning as we were trying to set up, and I discovered to my horror that I had neglected to bring a power supply for one of the devices here. We've patched something together here.
And yeah. It seems to be working all right.
Yeah.
So
very creative.
Happy to help. I'm glad I'd had the coffee this morning.
Yeah, so we're glad that you were able to put that together. So this episode, what we'll be doing again is we'll be bringing you some interviews with a variety of people here. We'll talk to some of the exhibitors. Maybe we'll talk to some of the attendees and hopefully some of the pilots outside as well can tell us about some of their airplanes. So you can look forward to that coming up.
It's going to be a great day.
It always is.
It's a good start. Looking good so far.
All right. We're speaking with Betty Chen from the Vertical Flight Society. Betty, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The Vertical Flight Society. Now, you recently rebranded the organization. Is that right?
That's correct. So since 1943, when our society was founded, it was first known as the American Helicopter Society. It was really established by a team of Sikorsky engineers who, at the beginning of the helicopter industry, felt that they needed an organization that would support their academic and professional needs. And since there wasn't one around, they started one themselves.
Yes.
And this included Igor Sikorsky, really the father of American helicopters helicopter industry, and a bunch of his colleagues and associates down in Connecticut. Or up in Connecticut.
Up in Connecticut, which is where I'm from.
Oh.
Yes, yes. I don't know if you know or not, but Igor Sikorsky III, his grandson, has a sporting camp up in the North Maine woods, not too far from where Micah hangs out.
I drove down from Portland, Maine yesterday.
Oh, that's very cool. Yeah, well, Igor Sikorsky's son, Sergei Sikorsky, was recently at our annual conference, which marked
Sergei is still...
Sergei is still alive and yes. Very much kicking, very supportive of what we do. He, you know, tries to come out to our annual conference when he can. Mm-hmm. It just so happened we just had our 75th anniversary,
nice.
Our 75th annual forum, which is the culmination of really what we do. So we bring all of our technical people together to present on 22 plus aerospace and aviation disciplines. And then we also have a trade show component to showcase like the latest, not only in rotorcraft and helicopter technology, but also yes. in vertical flight, which now includes drones and like micro aerial vehicles.
Yes. And
so that's why the name
changed. That's why the name
changed.
Vertical
right.
flight.
Right.
So it's, you're looking beyond just helicopters
right.
at any kind of
right.
any kind of vertical flight.
Exactly. So, as you may know, there's a huge interest right now in development of urban air mobility.
Exactly.
Uber and all these other companies are kind of, you know, they want to be the first to develop, you know, the first next generation vertical takeoff aircraft. And, you know, whether that's electric VTOL or like a hybrid, they're thinking that that's going to take us, you know, to like the next frontier.
Yes, yes. It's kind of optimistic. I was at right. the FAA UAS symposium in Baltimore just a couple of weeks ago, and urban air mobility was a big topic of conversation. Some of the sessions looked at that and some of the challenges and so forth. So is your organization trying to be involved in all the things that need to happen in order for urban air mobility to become a reality?
Well, actually, we were the first to develop next generation vertical takeoff and landing air vehicle workshop back in 2014. And since then, we've had, you know, I believe 4 or 5 more workshop where we're going to have our meeting in San Jose this January. And we're gathering not only people from the industry, but also academia and also government to discuss not only the technical developments and challenges, but also like the legislative challenges and the logistical challenges ahead. So I like to think that, you know, we've been following and we've been advancing this field before it became, you know, it came to everyone's forefront.
Yeah, before it became a thing.
Before it became a thing. So
yes.
Betty, I'm curious, you know, and how did you get involved with vertical flight in the society? What's your calling to vertical flight?
Oh, so I studied actually chemical engineering, but I wanted to be a teacher. Uh-huh. And so when I found a job with the Vertical Flight Society, I became their STEM and educational manager coordinator. And a part of my core responsibility is to develop educational content that's suitable for not only for you know university level, which we've been supporting that for a very long time, but more for like the K-12 crowd. Because we found that there were a lot of STEM materials and other aspects of, you know, of science and aerospace, but not very many. There's not a lot of curricula that's like that deals with helicopters or rotorcraft or necessarily drones.
Right, right.
Has that been easier to do, to reach out and create STEM materials for the K-12 group with the advent of inexpensive drones and UAVs to interest them in that?
I think yes and no. So the yes is, there are now really sophisticated equipment that you can buy for not a lot of money. But the challenge is to convert that from just a toy, from a novelty, to something that can have practical application, and then also to develop suitable learning materials for the younger audience, because there's a lot of very sophisticated physics and engineering involved, and to just break that down and still keep it really interesting can be a challenge.
for sure.
Because things like the forces of flight, it's not so easy to wrap your head around when you're young. A lot of these things you can't really see with your eyes. And we're, not trying to inundate them with any sort of calculus or any sort of physics. Yeah. And then when you strip all of that away, then the teachers are left with, how do I bring this really abstract concept to life for, young students.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a real challenge. That's a real challenge.
But having a drone, flying around does help kind of enliven that process and try to make things a little bit more, it's like easier to understand.
So what are you guys presenting here today? What do you have to show off?
So actually today's project is a bit of a surprise to me as well, because I'm actually supported by the University of Maryland's FIRE program. So it's, as I understand it, it's a undergraduate learning program that really any students, engineering or non-engineering students, can join. And it's a semester long, it's a 2-semester long class. And they just, whatever their learning stream is, they just dive in, work with a professor, and work on really hands-on projects. So today they're making a multi-rotor stand that tests, the flying capabilities of a tiny quadcopter.
Yes.
Okay. So they're actually building that here.
It's been built, but students can interact with it.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. Very cool.
And probably like see how the quad copter can fly under different conditions.
Sure.
Interesting.
And you guys have some of the best swag here, too.
Oh,
I mean, we got the greatest
you.
Keychain with a Vertical Flight Society keychain removed before vertical flight.
Oh, yeah. That's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek for those in the know. You know, as you know, they put these flight tags on important parts of like equipment on an aircraft just to like allow the pilot and the technicians to know you need to remove it.
Yes, yes.
So,
Betty, what kinds of people join the organization, the Vertical Flight Society?
We have close to 6,000 members worldwide. And while most of our members are engineers and scientists and technicians, we support anyone who works to advance the technology in vertical flight and the application. So our membership demographic ranges from university students to young professionals who are just getting into the field, you know, young engineers to very seasoned program managers to people who work in the government to, you know, advocate for, you know, the usage to just veterans, like, you know, retirees who, you know, may have retired from the field professionally, but they're still very enthusiastic and they still have a lot of knowledge to give.
And you have corporate members as well.
Correct. Yeah. So our corporate members include, you know, big, OEMs like Airbus and Boeing and Sikorsky, who kind of formed like the heart of the society.
Yes.
But we also support young startups. We support Uber. Mm-hmm. We support Jaunt Mobility. We support XTI. All of these companies are building, next generation electric or hybrid electric VTOL. We support a lot of individual members from NASA, all four branches of NASA. We support international and foreign companies like Volocopter in Germany, schools in Korea. It's just, I mean, our
it's very
kind
broad,
of our demographic is endless. You know, we think, you know, if you're interested in really furthering, you know, the technological advancement, then we want you and we want to be able to support your work.
Great.
One other question. I saw on the sheet you brought over that the Vertical Flight Society has a career center.
That's right.
And that's, you know, the pilot careers are very, very, they're wide open right now, but also it's still very hard to get. Can you tell us a little bit about the career section of the Vertical Flight Society?
Sure.
And by the way, if I'm asking you something you don't want to talk about or you can't answer, just, you know, we'll cut that right
out. Oh, yeah, sure. So our career center is very unique in that it is members only, which means only corporate members can post jobs, and then only, you know, active members can then seek out those jobs. And even though we support mostly the engineers, there are non-engineering roles and on the career center.
So it really pays to be a member.
It really does pay to be a member. Not only do we have careers, not only do we have, jobs, full-time and part-time jobs, we also have internships, fellowships, and co-ops that are available really all around the world.
Excellent. So tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about the Vertical Flight Society.
So our website is vtol.org.
Really? Perfect.
That's good.
please don't go to anything else. And
VTOL.org.
VTOL.org.
That's perfect.
That's great.
We've been around, we tend to, you know, support and hopefully bring everybody along to like the next generation of vertical flight, whatever that might be.
Yes, yes. Well, very good.
And Max, do you know that Betty Chen here is, this is my second favorite Betty that we've ever had on the podcast?
After Betty in the Sky?
Yeah, I don't know if I should ask who my competition is.
Betty in the Sky with a Suitcase, another great podcast, Betty Theske, and she's very well known. And and if you ever want to listen to a hysterically funny podcast from a flight attendant for a major airline, Hook up Betty and this guy with a suitcase.
I will. I'm honored to share the distinction.
Yeah. All right. Well, Betty, thank you so much for coming by, and have fun at the event today. And we wish you lots of success.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Barron and his son just came by and said hello. And, John, it's great to see you again.
It's good to see you as well.
Yeah, very nice. The shark is not here today.
Unfortunately, no. It's in the hangar because we're going to heading off to the Paris Air Show later this evening. So there was no time to get the logistics.
Yeah, too bad.
Well, we will eventually.
Yeah, I hope so. I think a lot of people would love to see the plane. So you're off to Paris?
Yep, we're going to Paris. You know, we have family out there. But not in Paris, but in France. But we're going to spend time, at the Paris Air Show, and then get some Women's World Cup going.
Is that right?
That should be awesome.
So are you going to be at the air show as just visitors? Or
Yeah, just visitors. So we're scoping it out. So the next time, we're going to bring an airplane out there.
Oh, great.
So
great.
We're kind of a tiny, tiny minnow in a ginormous ocean with people that are out there. So you want to know what's going on before you show up.
Sure. I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with the shark because we've talked with you and we've talked about it many times. But for our new listeners, maybe just describe the airplane a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the smaller airplanes that are out there. It's too small to be a real airplane or a certified airplane, and it's too fast and too complicated to be a light sport airplane. So it's kind of this weird experimental category. But it's a good time. You know, We fly at 150 knots, fly for 4 or 5 hours, get you places. But I really, really just use it around here, you know, teaching the kids how to fly, just keeping skills up. It's a neat little airplane. So hopefully, you know, if anybody's around, just come and ping me. We'll take them out flying.
Yeah. What airport do you fly out of?
Warrenton Fauquier Airport. So actually, I meant to mention, it's a great airport. You know, it's a classic 5,000 foot runway, but the people there are fantastic. Like, you know, you meet, you know, war heroes, old dudes that build satellites, dudes that are building their own airplane, dudes that fly jets. It's a great place to hang out with. You learn a lot there. Like, I think we typically spend 1 hour flying and we wind up spending 2 hours there just socializing. It's a good airport experience. And then, yeah, the other airport we go to is the Shannon Air Museum, Shannon Airport. Like, if you ever go flying with us, we'll take you out there. So there's an awesome diner there, and I don't know if that's the entire Virginia Aviation Museum. I think it's just part of it, but they have a really good collection out there as well.
And a good diner.
And an excellent diner.
Yeah, Shannon's a cool little airport, and so is Warrenton.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to check. You know, we have this little project we've been working on.
It's in. Yeah, I already turned it in.
Okay, good. It's eatattheairport.com, where we've been collecting airports that have eating establishments associated with them. Yeah, it's been pretty popular. We have a lot of people come to that website and take a look. It's kind of reliant on crowdsourcing, both to get new airports and restaurants into the database, but also to try to keep them current, because those kinds of diners, they go out of business. They come and go.
Yeah, it's funny. This place, as in the Washington, D.C. area, it's not the simplest place to fly because of the airspace, but there are all kinds of cool things. Like, you can go, you know, from here, you can go go east to Maryland. There's a bunch of places to eat out there. Go up to Pennsylvania. Go to, you know, Shannon. Go south to Richmond. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's always interesting to talk to people and, you know, realize you can, not only can you learn the airspace, which is fun here, but you can, you know, in an hour's flight from just about any of these places, you can have a grass strip with crabs on it. You can go to an oyster house. You can have a diner or any other stuff. It's a pretty cool area.
It's in the database as well. There's an airport called Bay Bridge right on the Eastern Shore. On the bay, right by the Bay Bridge, and, you know, going over to Annapolis.
Yes.
And, you know, when I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy, I used to, on our way home to Brooklyn, I'd always crest that bridge and go, oh, I wonder what's happening around there. I wish I could fly those things, right? And then, like, fast forward 30 years later, like, here we are, we're landing at the airport getting crabs.
You know,
it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, very good. Very good.
Well, if I come down early next year and we're going flying,
yeah,
you're taking me there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm either going to take you to the museum or the crab shack.
So. Yeah, I know that crab shack. I've eaten
at
that crab shack.
It's awesome.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah, my mother lives not too far from there.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So, yeah,
It's a challenge, though, bringing hot crabs home. Like, it stinks up the airplane, but we don't...
Not a good idea, not a good idea. So your son is here with you.
He is, yeah.
How's he been doing?
Good, good. So he's just back from school. So, you know, we use the airplane to pick up his stuff. It's interesting. It's, you know, a one-hour flight's a lot more tenable than four-hour drive, and it's a lot more fun, right? Yeah. So he gets to fly up and down. So, yeah, life is good.
Well, let's get you on. switch seats. So, how have you been? Are you keeping busy? How's the project coming along?
Oh, the project's been doing well. So about a year ago, we stopped working on it as much because all the boys went to college. One of them is at Georgia Tech, the other one's at Berkeley, and one of them is just about to start at University of Pennsylvania. I went to Penn State for a semester, and then the second semester I started my own, or I worked on another startup.
Right, right.
And I left that company, and now I'm just going to go back to school in the fall.
Okay. So tell us about, you know, we've spoken about the, you know, the great honors that that you all had in, you know, in winning the a competition for this project. So tell us again, refresh our listeners about the project a little bit.
Okay, so the project was called the Remora System. We made a head-mounted display for general aviation pilots. It was the purpose of it was to help pilots be aware of their airspeed at all times because the number one cause of accidents in general aviation is loss of control. And so we thought that the two most important pieces of information that pilots lose track of while their head is outside of the cockpit is airspeed and angle of attack. So if we could just keep that information in the pilot's field of view, we could, you know, greatly reduce the loss of control accidents in general aviation.
Yeah, it's a great concept. You guys made some progress, and like you say, now people grow up and head towards college, and so it, you know, it makes it different to keep the continuity there, I guess.
Yeah, it was a little difficult. I think we spent so much time in high school working on it that some of the boys were ready to go and move on from aviation. I don't think that they. They were ready to commit for long term.
Uh-huh.
And I think that it'll be good for us to go back and focus on it more as the concept and on the project itself and not worry about the, you know, business side of it. I think we got caught up in learning a lot of the business, you know, the things that you need to know to conduct a business.
Yes.
And I think just focusing on the product itself, or not just the product, the project, not the product, I think will be really, really helpful for us.
So what are you studying at college?
Studying to be a computer engineer now.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, I went into school thinking I was going to be an electrical engineer and I changed to computer engineer.
That's okay. Yeah. It's hard to know what you want to do when you start on that path, but you think it'll take you to aviation someday or not necessarily?
Yeah. I think, after college, I'm planning on joining the military.
Okay.
And, after that, you know, we'll see.
We'll see.
Who knows?
Great. All right. Well, are you enjoying the museum here?
Yeah, we love it. I come here maybe once every 3 months.
Yeah.
And there's always something new going around. There's always these beautiful airplanes. So it's good to just hang out and show my friends the airplanes and stuff. I made a promise to the AA that I was going to bring the youth into aviation as much as I could. So I'm always trying to pressure my friends into seeing more airplanes.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. It's wonderful when you have a... you know, a resource like this museum, and of course, there's lots of others around the country. But it is an opportunity to bring, well, your family, but also your friends or people you know, and you know, you never know when someone will catch the bug after being inspired by all this great stuff here.
Yeah, it's true. It's pretty interesting who you run into doing these things.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
All right. Well, it's good that you. Good to see you both.
Yeah, it's great to see you too.
Are you going to Paris too? Everybody's
yep,
the family's
the whole
going
family.
To Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. So have a good time.
Yeah.
Have you been to the air show, to the Paris air show?
No, we've never been to the air show before.
Yeah. Me either. Mm. Mike has been.
No, I haven't been to Paris. I've been to Farnborough.
Oh, Farnborough.
But Launchpad Marzari is there.
That's right. He's there. We think he's there as we speak. After a little aircraft issue, I guess, necessitating a turn back and dumping fuel and all of that. Apparently some of the instrumentation was not what it needed to be to cross the Atlantic, so they had to come back. But I'm sure Launchpad will give us a full report in the near future about that. So, but the both of you, thanks for stopping by. It's great to see you, as always.
It's great to see you, too. Thank you.
All right, thank you. You encounter all kinds of people here at the museum. Certainly, there's a lot of kids that come, young people that come, but there are attendees of all ages. And occasionally, you'll see someone looking at one of the aircraft here, and you know that there is some kind of a connection. And so as across from us is a P-47, a nice P-47. And a gentleman was having his picture taken in front of it, a senior citizen. And we could just tell there was some kind of a connection there. And Micah, we're really pleased to have someone kind of special here.
Yes, we were looking across at the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, and it was none other than a gentleman we just met, Mr. Oscar Gagliardi, who we found out used to fly P-47s in the Peruvian Air Force back in the 1950s.
Yeah, so tell us about this airplane. Was it an easy airplane to fly? Did you enjoy flying it?
The plane is similar to the United States because Peru is the Inter-American. Work with the American, but no instructor.
No instructor?
No.
So
the instructor is from Peru.
A Peruvian instructor.
Peruvian. I fly the T-33.
Okay.
Before. After that, I was instructor in T-33.
Ah, very good.
And after that, I got to fly P-47.
The P-47.
Yeah.
And how many years did you fly the P-47?
3 years.
3 years.
3 years.
Yes, yes.
Now, in looking at the P-47 and flying it, it looks like it would be very heavy on the controls, that it would be very difficult.
No.
Was it difficult to fly?
No, because I fly the T-6.
No? So from the T-6 Texan to the
P... The same instruction, the United States Stearman, T-6. And after that, go to the T-33 or P-47.
Yes, yes.
No? And all the life is, I wanted, say, fighter pilot. No? Fighter pilot is good airplane.
Yes.
No, the fire with the aerobatic maneuver is very good. I made Tiro song. No. And after that, recover that.
Yes, or, yes.
No, but two classmates pass away.
In the dive.
In that dive, yeah. Yes.
The P-47 was known as the heaviest single engine fighter in the U.S. Air Force during World War II, and the nickname for it in the U.S. was the Jug, because if you stand it on end, if you look at it with the nose to the ground and look at the shape of the fuselage, it looks like a milk jug. Was there a nickname for the P-47 in Peru? Was there anything different that it was called, that the pilots called it, or it was referred to?
Apollo? No.
Just P-47.
The good fighter. The good fighter fly this airplane.
Yeah.
If you don't good, you don't fly this airplane.
No. After you flew the P-47, did you then fly other airplanes?
See, after that I fly the Mirage.
The Mirage?
Mirage. After that, I was instructor in T-37, A-37, pick up airplane to United States, to Peru, many times.
Oh, so you would deliver the airplanes, fly them to Peru from the United States. Yes, yes.
Everybody by say to me, gringo.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Because my hair is gringo, no?
Yes, yes.
But I don't speak very well English, no, in this time, no? I speak French a little.
Yes.
No? But it's good. To go. The classmate, is the ambition is a fighter pilot.
Uh-huh.
Transport airplane. Oh, I don't like this. No, it's no way. No.
Yeah, it's about flying. I see you have a flying hat on, too.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So do you fly often now?
I fly in the B-26.
The B-26?
The B-26, I fly because it's maneuver very good.
If you fly now.
Now?
I fly
now.
Right?
And
he has a little fly simulator.
He made a simulator in the basement on his home.
Your son has a flight
complete.
Simulator.
He made that.
Yeah, with a
then I fly.
With a cool. with a cockpit. I mean,
yeah,
with a
full size
cockpit.
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
I fly this.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
How did he learn how to make a simulator? Did you teach him?
No.
Well, being with him so many years at the Air Force Base, that's like an inspiration to. Like airplanes.
Yes, your father was an inspiration for you, yes.
Did you build is it a replica of a specific aircraft or?
No, it's just, it follows a lot of the 737,
mm-hmm.
but I put joysticks on the side because he was like, I don't want
a yoke.
Joystick. So I put joysticks for him.
Yeah, yes.
And then he has another little one at his house.
Very good.
Yeah, like
that's great.
He uses to fly almost every day.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, once an aviator, always an aviator, right?
No, I have a lot. I have my all the. You fly the B-47?
No, no.
And you? No. Are you?
My grandfather did.
Your grandfather?
I did not. I fly Cessnas, but my grandfather flew
B-47s. Yeah, yeah. These are wings.
Oh, yeah, look at the wing from the Peruvian Air Force.
From the Peruvian Air Force.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. We'll take a picture of that.
We'll put this up on the website for our show notes so that people can see your wings from the Peruvian Air Force.
Yeah. He says that you don't have it.
Oh, no.
No.
Yeah. I have
another. He has many other ones. He wants you to have.
Yes.
Well, then, please take one of our pins.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to put this on. This is a beautiful pin.
Thank you.
Mike has taken a photo of it, and like he said, we'll put it in the show notes, but this is really spectacular. Thank you so much. Thank you for talking with us.
And thank you for talking with us.
Muchas gracias.
Yeah, it's But it's our pleasure. Have a great day at the museum.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Bishop O'Connell High School Engineering Club is here today, one of the exhibitors, and we have Kayvon and Alex with us. Guys, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much.
So tell us about the, your table, what you have set up and what you're trying to accomplish today.
So basically we're showing what we do in our engineering club. So we do amateur radio, we do Sea Perch, which is underwater robotics, and we make satellites, which we launch into space. So.
Well, you make satellites that you launch into space.
Yeah.
So how do they get up into... Well, first tell us, what do the satellites do?
So they measure various things. So far, we've only made one. We're making another one that we're going to launch, I think, early next year. The one that we've made, it measures UV light. So it's kind of like that gives you sunburns, visible light, and then accelerometer for acceleration, gyroscope for which way you're pointing, and magnetometer, which is basically a compass. And then what else? There's temperature and like battery voltage and stuff like that. But yeah, so... we're just trying to study more things about extremely low Earth orbit, which is, well, lower than low Earth orbit, where the, like, International Space Station is and a lot of satellites.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners probably understand low Earth orbit, you know, the differences, but maybe not all of them do. So tell us a little bit about, what does that mean, low Earth orbit?
So it means that it's just on the edge of our sort of top of the atmosphere and then outer space. We don't really know a lot about that area. We know about low Earth orbit from the International Space Station, but extreme low Earth orbit is sort of, you know, new territory. And it's, you know, we want in the future study things like particle frequency as well as radiation in that area of orbit.
So now let's talk about how these satellites get up into low Earth orbit. What's the launch vehicle that's being used here?
So we use Northrop Grumman. Well, it was Orbital, but then it was bought by Northrop Grumman. It's Antares. So we hitch along on a ride to the International Space Station. And on the way there, right after it circularizes the orbit, it gets, I think, pretty sure it's a spring mechanism that launches it out the side along with like 60-ish other satellites, right? 60?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Is this the, what do they call it, NanoCube or Cube satellite or something? Is that
so
something
it's
different?
Smaller than CubeSat. The form factor CubeSat. We're using, it's called ThinSat. It's invented by the same guy who invented CubeSat. And essentially, it's like if you take a CubeSat and then chop it up into like slices, they each about the size of a piece of bread, so a slice of toast. So we named our satellite ToastSat.
Yeah. That's good. I like
it gets
that.
Gets burnt when it's re-entering.
Yeah.
So it takes the same launch. When you have a bunch of them, you use the same launcher that you have for a CubeSat because, you know, same size, same, basically the same.
But the advantage is that it's because it's so thin, it saves space and you can put more and do more than you would with a CubeSat.
Interesting.
So literally, this satellite with all these sensors is the size of a slice of white bread?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and then it
basically
has like solar panels that fold out from that. And then those solar panels connected to other satellites. So then it's kind of like a string of satellites. And then each one, to save money and, like, you know, space, there's only two radios per string. So at each end, you have a radio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And these are high school students. Yeah. When I was in high school, we thought it was a big deal if we could launch a model rocket. And that was it. I mean, that was a big deal. And here you are now, all these many, many years later, launching satellites. So where does the where does the knowledge come from that allows you to do this? What are the resources that that teach you the things you need to know in order to construct these satellites and get them into space?
Well, we our engineering club moderator Melissa Poor does a lot of guidance. And we've gotten a lot of funding through her and through her networking, as well as her know-how of sort of, you know, space and just navigating the technicalities of being able to launch. And we actually were the first ThinSat mission. We were sort of the tip of the spear, you know, edge of the knife, if you will. So we did a lot of the teaching ourselves. We had to sort of write procedure as we went. And tell, you know, the developers, hey, we've run into this problem. What do you have for us? And help teach them, you know, as well as ourselves, how to actually do a ThinSat.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about the science there. I mean, with these sensors and with this data that's collected. Well, how does the data retrieved from the satellite?
So we use the Global Star Network of satellites, and they will transmit the data to a global dashboard so that anybody basically can use the information that we collect, which I think is really important. And then from there, you go onto your dashboard and retrieve the information that way. The sensory chips are made by a South African company, X in a Box. They, you know, their mission is to help get girls into STEM, and we use their chips because they're very easy to use and get the job done.
Wow, this is incredible. How large is the group, the engineering club?
Well, there's a lot of people in it. Then, like, a lot of them don't really exactly, like, you know, aren't there all the time. But the people who work on the satellites, I think it's like maybe like 12-ish people.
Yeah. It's yeah, I think the core group is something around 8. We have, I want to say 24 members. But that's the kind of the cool thing about our club is that it's not necessarily an everyday commitment because we have so many diverse, you know, people. You know, we've got the band kids, the athletes, you know, the computer nerds, like people with all different types of commitments, but we're still able to come together and have, you know, 4 people this day can work during study hall. You know, after school, we can get 9 people together to help, you know, run things about Sea Perch. And, you know, it all comes together with our various skill set. And it works.
So you said the satellites, obviously they re-enter and toast. Yes. How long are they flying once they get in there?
So because it's in extremely low Earth orbit where there's more atmospheric drag, it only was in orbit for 5 days or 6 days, six-ish days. But so that's kind of the reason why there isn't much setting there, because most satellites, they cost like millions of dollars. So it doesn't make sense to have a $1 million satellite, launch it into space, and only have it in space for 5 days. That's kind of, you know, a waste of your money. When you could just put it a bit higher up and have it in there for 5 years. So that's, since this is a lot cheaper, it makes it worthwhile to put a satellite in extremely low Earth orbit.
And on top of that, it also cuts down on space junk because you're not leaving, you know, satellites that don't, you know, transmit anymore or that are just kind of floating. Instead, it burns up and disintegrates in the atmosphere.
You know, and let me ask you another question that we probably should have asked up front, but it's kind of a silly question. But where is Bishop O'Connell High School?
We are in Arlington, Virginia. And, Arlington, Virginia. Go Knights.
Go Knights.
I thought it was interesting when you commented about sort of the diversity of people in the group.
Yeah.
Which I think that's really interesting. I mean, because maybe it's stereotypes, but normally, you know, others make this up. The chess club is kind of one type of, you know, the band club is, you know, the band is another type.
Certainly.
But how did you arrive at having all these different types of students involved in this kind of a project? I think that's fascinating.
Well, me personally, I was driving home from school one day, listening to NPR, you know, like a teenager, and I heard a story about, you know, small sats. I was like, oh, that's cool. Next day at school, I hear on the announcements, any interested students who want to send a satellite to space, fill out an application. You know, I was like, are you kidding me? I filled mine out. You know, I come in this room, and it's a lot of different people who just came together because of space and wanted to be a part of something that was first of its kind and something that I think will have a lasting impact on space and the way we interact with space.
Yeah. I mean, another thing is also, since we know we have the we have the Sea Perch and the, you know, amateur radio and all that. So, like, these people who aren't so interested in space, but they want to do, like, the amateur radio or the, like, Sea Perch. So they'll do that, and then they'll be like, oh, you know what, maybe I do want to do this space stuff. And
yeah, I was going to ask you, in the group, do people kind of specialize in certain, you know, aspects of this whole thing? I mean, because, you know, there's design and there's construction and there's just all these different aspects to pulling something like this off. Do people kind of specialize?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have someone who kind of helps us do like our external relations. We have someone who helps us. One of the students helps us do that. And then like I don't really know anything about ham radio, so I don't really do that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm trying to learn more, but
no, yeah, so that's absolutely right. Like, we have some people who are more on like the big picture goals, like motivating people and helping sort of direct. We've got kids who are really into actually the coding of the chips. We got other people that are more into actually the hardware and the satellite itself and getting it to be the most efficient it can be. And I think that's also, again, what makes it work is we all found our little niche and figured it out.
So, Alex, where do you think you'll go from here? Where do you think your path might lead you someday?
I think I'm probably going to do something in aerospace, like maybe, I don't know, something to do with rockets or satellites, but I'm not sure.
You're young. How about you, Kayvon?
I'm going to the University of Virginia. I'm going to study biology and environmental science. And, you know, from there, potentially grad school, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Great. Terrific. You guys are doing really fascinating things. This has got to be a great experience that I think you'll probably learn things that will carry forward, you know, throughout your entire life. So these kinds of things are really powerful. Is there some place, is there a web page or some place where people who are interested in, you know, kind of maybe learning more about what you guys are doing?
Well, certainly you can follow Bishop O'Connell on Twitter, and the high school itself will, you know, tweet updates about our club whenever we do, you know, reach a milestone. I mean, you could follow Melissa Poor on Twitter. I don't know her handle off the top of my head. But yeah, so Bishop O'Connell High School Twitter account. And if you find any tweets about, you know, the ThinSat program, they'll most likely include Melissa Poor, who you should follow as well for updates if you want to know more.
All right, great. Thanks again for coming and talking with us. Have a great event. Hope you get a lot of people come see your table and talk to you guys.
Absolutely.
You're doing great stuff again. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Nick Murray has joined us. Nick what is your position here at the museum?
So I'm the family day coordinator. So I help make sure that events like this go on and are fun for families and aviation enthusiasts and space enthusiasts, things like that. So, but my job is mainly to make sure these events happen and everything's where it's supposed to be.
Well, you're doing a great job, let me tell you. And we were talking earlier, we've been here 8 years now, each year annually, and just love coming to the Air and Space Museum, love coming to the family
Innovations of Flight Day is where we're at right now.
I know it so well because we talk about it all the time.
Yeah, but no, honestly, the name has changed a little bit over time. Apparently, it started off years ago as like Be a Pilot Day.
Yes.
And now it's changed to Innovations. It can be a little confusing sometimes.
So how long have you been doing this with the museum, and what kind of things does it take?
Yeah, so just right now I'm coming in about my second year with the museum, really. Before this, I'd worked for a couple other government agencies, the biggest one being the National Park Service, and mostly working in the world of education. But I started doing permits for the National Park Service, and so when you start doing that, you have to really know how to put these events together, make sure all the ducks are in a row, everybody who needs to know something needs to know, and working with, you know, security and all these other different groups, and even sometimes outside organizations and agencies. And so it kind of put me in a unique position to be a candidate for this job.
Well, this has got to take so much amazing coordination, because your deal, we were going to interview you a minute ago, and you said, give me a minute, I got to go check on lunch, because I don't think who knows what happened.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But how do you organize an event that is so vast and such a vast place with so many different people and aircraft coming in and people from coming all over the country, sometimes all over the world? Tell us about your day or your weeks.
Yeah, so building up to this, we start having meetings months in advance, usually about 3 to 4 months, and we just start delegating. Everybody here within the museum has some sort of role. I should say at least every department within this museum has some sort of role. A lot of our conservation and restoration folks, they do a lot of the ground school kind of stuff, so getting the planes and the spots. And some of them will do this on their everyday week and just kind of donating any other time to air shows in the area. And so we start work with them right away of like, hey, what's our capacity? What can we start doing? And the best part about being here at the Udvar-Hazy Center is that we're just right here at the Dulles Airport. Yes. And so we have to work a lot with the FAA there and the Metropolitan, we call them MWA. I can't remember what the whole acronym is now, but the Washington Metropolitan Airport Authority, essentially, and getting them on board and making sure that they got everything just for security reasons and stuff like that. And we actually have some gates that kind of separate us from them. Mm-hmm. And so to make sure that all those gates are open and the planes will literally land at Dulles, taxi over here. We have our own taxi that brings them all the way over here. And so it takes a lot of planning, working with a lot of outside groups like that. And then just starting reaching out. We always reach out to the military first to see what airplanes they might have available.
That's always a big draw. That's always popular.
And especially this year, too, we got an F-22.
Yes.
I think that's the first time we've been able to get one of those things in. And so we were very happy that ended up working out. It's the thing, too, is the different aircraft, each one has its own unique thing. Last night we got the, I can't think of what it's called now, the big cargo plane, the C-17.
The C-17,
yeah,
yes.
C-17. And we had to have people outside making sure that the wings would be able to fit through our taxiway and not run into any of the trees. And so
right. that was that's the other been thing. A problem in the
yeah.
past.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of the other things we have to coordinate is making sure our maintenance team's out there and have cleared the trees and stuff like that. So it's just all those little details, working with everybody who's been here for a long time and making sure we get everything done.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a lot of special presenters that you get in just for this event. I mean, you invite us, God knows why. But, you know, and then we just interviewed somebody from Bishop O'Connell High School,
yeah.
and the 99s are here, yeah. and the Air Force Academy is here. Where do you find all these people and get them to come down?
A lot of them come to us, and that's what makes my job really easy, in fact, is that being that we're, you know, the Smithsonian, the National Air and Space Museum, so many people want to work with us. And so it's really trying to find what's the best place for them, and especially with groups like the 99s. We try to encourage them to come out to all these things because we really want to make sure that young women especially are starting to become interested in this and know that there's an outlet for them. United actually is the one that deserves the biggest credit. They bring in their plane, but they're also the major sponsor for
Big
the
sponsor,
event.
Big sponsor, yes.
Yeah.
Are you listening, Brian Coleman? United has done a wonderful, wonderful thing, Brian. Have you heard this?
I've been going around a couple of times already. Having all these groups that have either interest in coming out or have traditionally been out here makes my job a lot easier because they already know what's going on. And we just try to expand, learn the lessons from last year, and what can we do to make this a bigger and better experience for the following year.
Was there something that you said to the staff here about what we wanted to or what you wanted to accomplish this year with this event?
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, every year we try to do something a little bit different and a little bit more unique. We really try to aim this year for trying to do Apollo stuff, being that it's the 50th anniversary for Apollo. Just unfortunately, like we were trying to get some of the aircraft that astronauts would have trained on and stuff like that. It just didn't work out. But the way to recognize that, we do have NASA out here today. We're actually going to be doing a radio broadcast with them here at about 2 o'clock that, we call it a downlink. And so that was kind of our way of recognizing, NASA and celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. But then other than that, it's always our main focus is the next generation. What can we do to get kids, families interested in aerospace and flying and anything, get them out there looking at planes, listening to stuff like this, to kind of help let them know that this is actually an option. There's potential for jobs out here or just as your everyday hobbyist. And I can't think of a better place to do that than here at the Udvar-Hazy Center.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And it's great to see the small children, young children, some of them quite small. I mean, the parents are bringing, you know, all of their kids,
oh, yeah.
you know, all ages. I don't think there's an age where it's too early to, you know, kind of ignite that spark in some youngster that might see these things and think seriously about what they want to do next.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's my ultimate goal. If 10 years from now some kid comes up to me or at that point maybe an adult says, hey, it was coming here and during one of these events, that's what would make my job feel like I've actually done something. But, yeah, to try to get to the kids, we have activities for all sizes. We have like a Fisher-Price take apart airplane thing where kids could just sit there and kind of start to learn the parts of it and take it apart and try to put it back together. We have them in like airplane costumes flying around doing air traffic control stuff where they'll try to get on a runway and learn to take off and see how all that stuff works out. So we try to get them as early as possible.
Yeah. And what kind of numbers do you see here at the museum on a day like today or compared to a normal Saturday?
Yeah, so hopefully today, it wouldn't surprise me if we get 20,000 people out here today, just from what I've seen out the parking lot and people inside here. But usually on a typical weekend over the summer, we could get 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 on a good day out here.
So this is a huge draw of a day.
Yeah, this will probably actually be our second biggest event here at the year. Our biggest one always is Aaron Scare. We always host
Halloween.
It shortly before, Halloween, free candy for that one always brings out a lot of people, another chance for them to wear their Halloween costumes. And so that one usually brings in close to about 30,000.
No kidding.
So this right here is probably our second biggest event that we have throughout.
Excellent. Well, we're really honored to be, part of this, and we love coming here, but as I said before, we love talking about it on the show, and we see a lot of listeners come in.
Oh, yeah.
Not only is this attendees, but folks flying in, too. We got a number of the airplanes out there. We're flown in by some of our friends and listeners.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's actually the biggest crop that we get is the general aviation enthusiasts that fly in. Yeah. We try to get a lot of military, but that takes up a lot of space. The smaller everyday aircraft that people can fly is kind of the bread and butter that brings a lot of the big aviation people out here. And it's always kind of fun because those planes are a lot more approachable. You can't get close to the F-22, but yeah, you could actually, it's a little bit easier to have that talk with the enthusiast pilot or the hobbyist pilot out here and kind of hear their story and how they got interested in it.
And I think the pilots have fun. I think they enjoy talking to the, especially the kids, but anybody who comes up and shows an interest in their airplane or asks questions about their airplane or just even says, what is that?
Yeah.
I think the pilots love to talk aviation to people who are, you know, interested in that. So,
that's great.
That's great. Hopefully I'll get outside. The trouble with being inside behind this table with all these microphones is I don't get to spend much time outside. But
yeah, I haven't actually made a chance out to venture out there yet either. So I'm hoping to get to do that soon as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to. I want to see that F-22, having come from a career with Pratt & Whitney and knowing a lot about those engines. It's always great to see that aircraft. So,
yeah.
Nick, I'm sure you've got a lot of things to do today.
No problem.
Congratulations on what's always been just a really successful and fantastic event. Thanks for spending a few minutes talking with us.
Thanks for talking. All right. Have a good one.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, as always.
Thank you.
All right, Airplane Geeks, this is Robert filling in for David and all the missing people here, walking around outside at the Innovations in Flight event, and I've just bumped into Victoria Newville from the Stuck Mike Avcast. So in our continuing theme of Podcast today, we're doing some crossovers here, and Victoria's here with the 99s and had some interesting experiences coming in here today. So here's Victoria.
Hey there, nice to see you guys out. It's a beautiful day.
So tell us about what you're doing with the 99s here today.
Well, the 99s are an organization of women pilots. It was founded by Amelia Earhart in 1942. So we don't actually, I think there is a booth around here somewhere. I haven't found it yet because I've been so busy. But there's a bunch of us walking around just spreading the news to a lot of the ladies here come up and they're kind of hesitant to ask questions about the airplanes. And a lot of the time they don't realize that women can be pilots. So we're just kind of here to spread the word and tell them about what's going on.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And you're right. It's interesting to see how people don't always, a lot of people aren't stepping up, and particularly the women. I think the 99s are inside running some Redbirds, actually. I saw their booth in there. So I think that's what they're doing. So tell us about your experience coming in here today as well.
I flew in a flight of two of gyros. We have a Magni gyro and an MTO Sport by Auto Gyro. And to come into 11,000 foot runway at Dulles, where a GA airplane usually doesn't come in, was amazing. And these are open cockpit aircraft. So I landed and I had helmet/wind hair. So I look great for everyone that I'm meeting today and trying to promote aviation with. Just look for the girl with the crazy hair.
There's a reason we brought radio equipment today and not cameras. It's probably better for all of us involved. So what do you fly normally for people that may not know?
Right now I'm flying a Cessna 172 and then also a Decathlon. I'm working on my flight instructor actually. So that'll be done in the 172. It's kicking my butt, but it is an excellent rating that I advise, you know, if you have the opportunity and have the desire to teach, it's going to really broaden your horizons and your ability in aviation.
Sounds like a plan. Appreciate it. Thanks. You have a great day.
You too. Nice running into you.
Likewise. Thanks. Hello again, Airplane Geeks. This is Robert filling in. I'm out here on the ramp behind the Udvar-Hazy Center here with Captain Bear Williams, U.S. Air Force, with the 27th Fighter Squadron out of Langley Air Force Base, which has a particular meaning for me in that my grandfather, who flew for the Air Force for 40 years, retired out of that air base and spent a lot of time down there myself. We're going to talk to him a little bit today about his experiences. Bear, how are you doing today?
Doing good. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. So so tell us a little bit about your background. How did you find yourself flying?
Yeah, so my father was fortunate enough to grow up in aviation, and he helped me learn to fly growing up. Went to college at William & Mary, and then I was looking for a job post-college, and I got lucky enough to be hired by the Air Force, and I've been fortunate along the way, so here we are.
Sounds like quite a good path. William & Mary, huh? Are you a local Virginia boy then?
I am. Family from here.
My parents both went to William & Mary, so that's sounds like we have a lot of similar background here. So so you learned to fly elsewhere. What did you fly in before you got in the Air Force?
The first airplane I had the privilege of flying was a Cessna 150, which was awesome, $13,500, and it was epic. Got to fly a Nanchang CJ-6, assortment of Cessnas and Pipers growing up, which I'm very grateful for. And then into the Air Force, T-6s, T-38s, and on to here.
Very nice. So how long have you been in the Air Force now?
Air Force, about 9 years.
I take it you like it then.
I do enjoy the job.
So tell us a little bit about what your day-to-day is in the Air Force when you go flying. What are your normal trips? What do you do with this aircraft?
Yeah, so most of our training is going to be at our home station, by and large, with the F-22. We're going to be doing local training sorties about an hour to an hour and a half each, mostly focusing on our primary mission, which is air dominance, or the owning, if you will, of airplanes, or of the airspace from other airplanes. We'll fly maybe 3 times a week on average, if I had to say, for about that 1 to 1.5 hour each time. Most of our work, if you will, is going to be coordinating for those flights, both planning it, coordinating with all the other agencies. And then if you can imagine like a good sports team, we go fly and everything happens pretty quick. Then we spend the rest of our day trying to figure out what just happened. So we do a lot of tape watching, analyzing, coming up with better plans for tomorrow just to make ourselves a little bit better.
Very nice. And I presume you would like to stay on this aircraft for a while?
I do enjoy this airplane.
So how about the event? Have you been up here before? What are your impressions?
No, impressions are very favorable, actually, and the museum is amazing. I never had the chance to be here before. This is our first time at the event. I'm privileged to be here for that. We're glad to get the F-22 up here, especially how close we are. But we're looking forward to more if we can make the stars align, which I think we will.
Sounds good. It's nice to have you guys here. I know a lot of people were excited about this aircraft. When you guys went overhead this morning, everybody's ears perked up inside and kind of went, oh, they did make it. You know, so that's kind of cool and got a pretty nice turnout here and nice weather today. So where are you guys headed from here?
So I'll take this airplane back tonight. I think the unit is just going to be staying down at Langley doing our standard training until we go on the road again here probably in August to September. But, yeah, we're happy to be here. And this is a really neat event. It's good to see all the people and kids out.
So with all these kids around and people coming to see, what would you you see people out here that are interested in a career in aviation or particularly a career in military aviation, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I'd say I go for it. I love it. It's tough at times, and we all know that. But most things in life, I think, that are worthwhile can be difficult. So I wish I could help them more than just talk to them here. But no kidding, all the standard platitudes, don't give up, work hard, keep success and good grades, things like that, so that you have options. And then most importantly, don't ever take no for an answer, because I got told no or probably not many times on the way, and here we are. So keep going.
Well, congratulations. Very nice talking with you, and you guys have a great afternoon. Looks like it should be a very nice flight back.
Yeah, thanks a million.
Thank you. Hello again, Airplane Geeks. Robert outside here, standing next to Mr. Frank No, who we've discovered shared a hangar a few doors down from me at Frederick Airport here, and has had a very interesting experience flying a fairly unique aircraft into Dulles here. So let's talk to him a little bit about that. Frank, how are you doing this afternoon?
All good here. Very good.
So tell us about this aircraft we're looking at here.
This is a gyroplane, also known as autogyro. Some people call them gyrocopters. Basically, most people think it's a helicopter because it has the rotor, but the rotor's unpowered. All the power comes from thrust, and it pushes us forward and keeps that rotor spinning.
Yeah, it's an interesting-looking aircraft, nice open-air experience. So I'd be a little bit different flying this thing into an airport like Dulles today, huh?
That's one of my favorite things about this event, is actually just bringing it into Dulles, since I'm used to going into, you know, 500,000-foot grass strips, and here I was today. I landed on a 13,000-foot runway, which was interesting.
Yeah, a little bit different sight picture, look a little bit strange. So tell us about your experience coming in here. I imagine the routing was a little bit funny, and, you know, this may be a little too nerdy for airplane nerdy for some of the listeners, but I'm awfully curious what they did with you coming in at the speeds these things go.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, I do come in here professionally all the time, so I knew what to expect. So I took off from Frederick, which is 32 miles north. At about 25 miles north, they said, you're cleared, go direct to, not clear to land, but go direct to runway 19 left. I thought to myself, I'm only doing 65 knots. They don't know what they're thinking. But normally in a fast-moving jet, you're cleared that far out, not to land, but to go direct. So I just kind of piped back and said, I'm able to offset, if you like, to the east, which made sense. He said, no, you're okay. So I think it took him about 2 minutes to realize that someone was coming up my tail really quickly. And he said, oh, yeah, could you make a turn to the east and offset? I said, sure, that's a good idea. So we did that, and a couple guys, even people, other planes come into this event, you know, even doing 100 knots, they kind of went past. And finally, I guess someone else overshot their runway, and he it had me turn direct to the west, go under the center line to 19 left, And he cleared me to land 19 center for some reason, which I thought was kind of cool. And so we did that, and it was nice because it had a nice long taxi, like past all the big jets, which I enjoyed.
That's fun. That's an interesting one for coming in a place like this. So what do you fly professionally then?
I fly regional jets for a small regional airline here.
Okay, cool. So this is home base for you. Little different. Yep. That's a nice change coming in on a different aircraft, your own aircraft, different view. I mean, I get to fly around the airspace, usually cutting through, going south here between just east of the field here. There's sort of an unofficial corridor that they'll let us use sometimes.
Is that the east transition?
East transition, and we'll be, as you probably know, either right above or right below you guys getting turned around for direction of operations. And it's all seen some interesting stuff from that angle, which is always fun as well. So how long are you in here? You headed out today?
Oh, yeah, we're only 30 miles north. As soon as they shut down today, we're going to push in front of everyone, as I did last year. It worked great. I'm going to get ahead of everyone, be the first ones out. And we got a nice tailwind going home.
Sounds like a great day. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let me just ask you a question, Max.
What?
Do you remember First Officer Craig?
I remember First Officer Craig.
He was a great guy, and I really miss him, but he's not with us anymore.
Oh.
Now, really? Where did he go? What happened to First Officer Craig?
I don't know. That's a good question. You probably, all my brains are scattered everywhere after the rigmarole I went through the last couple weeks of captain upgrade training. Went through about a week of, week and a half of ground school, had a week off, got to relax and recuperate, and then went through almost 2 weeks of sim training because one night it was sim number four. We were about halfway through. My sim partner was about 700 feet above the ground on a single engine ILS, and power went out in the simulator building, and so we had to call it quits for that night, and everything got pushed back. But after a long journey, it's me and my sim partner both passed our check rides, and we're both moving on to become captains of Acme Junior. So,
well, let me just say congratulations.
Thank you.
Welcome, Captain Craig, to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
It's got a nice ring to it, doesn't it?
It does. Really does. It does. So what does it take to go down that path of becoming a captain? I mean, do you say, I want to be captain, or does the company say, we want you to be a captain? How does it happen?
It's kind of a little mix of both. You have to bid for it, so you have to have the seniority to hold captain. I waited an extra month just to make sure I could hold captain in DCA where I'm based. I could have got it a month early if I went to LaGuardia or Newark, but I drive to work, so I'm trying to keep it that way. So it's seniority, flight time. You have to have the flight time requirements that the company and the union outline in the contract. And if you get those met, you go to training, and as long as you pass all the training requirements, you'll upgrade to captain. So
was it difficult?
I think me and all my classmates thought we were more stressed and put a lot of the stress on ourselves than we needed to.
Pressure.
Yeah, we put pressure on ourselves. We felt afterwards, we're all like, oh, that wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be, because we knew the plane. We've, at least for me, I have 2,000 hours in the Embraer 175, so it's moving over 3 feet, but it's the same plane, so there's not a whole lot different than using your hands opposite of what you've been doing. And
that's what I wanted to ask you. You've been flying the plane. You've got 2,000 hours in it. Other than being the one, I mean, PIC kind of changes, you know, back and forth with the flying and monitoring. Other than having final authority or final responsibility, what changes when you become a captain?
Your pay rate, your title, the extra stripe on your epaulets and jacket sleeves, and the little emblem on the hat or the hat brim, that changes. But
in terms of flying, what is the training that you're going through?
In terms of in ground school is really kind of just I guess a more compressed and more informative new hire class, where we just went through the company flight ops manual and standard operating procedures and some of the systems, but we've all been through it before. So the only different class we got in ground school is Captain Command Leadership class, and that was the most beneficial that we all got out of the class, the whole ground school. And it was a whole day class where we basically went scenario from hotel to hotel. So hotel, getting on the bus to the airport, going through security, getting on the plane, doing all the pre-flight checks. And in this our scenario, one of the flight attendants didn't show up for the flight time or for the van time. So it's, oh, so what do? Do you go check on her? Do you go and hope she meets you at the plane? And it was kind of nice to get that perspective of other captains who were teaching the class and what other people in the class thought they would do in that situation. So I think that was the most beneficial part of the ground school.
It sounds like the case studies we did back in business school.
Yeah. It was kind of nice because it's like, in this scenario, would you either, and there's kind of like no right or wrong answer. It's just kind of right or right. And it's like, oh, some people would stay, go check on her until she gets out of her room or whatever. Some people like tell the hotel, hey, when she gets up, can you tell her we're all waiting for her at the airport or whatever. So it was nice to see different perspectives, not only for the outside the plane, but also dealing with issues inside the aircraft during the flight as well.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Is there any kind of, initiation or, you know, do the other captains pay any special attention to you, or you just slide right in and off you go?
I mean, we had good instructors there to answer any questions, so there wasn't no initiation like a frat house or anything like that, but we did meet a few new hires while we were in ground school and gave them an initiation to the company. So.
But nothing we can talk about here.
Yeah, rather not say, but we did have a good time. So
everybody learns a secret handshake, I suppose.
Of course, yes.
So what happens in terms of your seniority? Have things changed in terms of how you can choose your routes and your flights?
Yeah, so when I finished up as a first officer in the month of May, I was number 20-ish out of 110 and based in DCA. And I just looked at my seniority for the month of June, and I'll be 5 from the bottom out of 125 for the captain sign DC. So pretty much getting slim pickings and whatever's at the bottom of the barrel that everybody else chooses from.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So how much flying are you doing? How many hours a month?
Right now, none. I just got back from sim training on Tuesday. Okay. It's Saturday now. And as from what I've heard, OE, which is operational experience, is backed up for the next 20 to 25 days. So I'll be sitting at home collecting my minimum monthly guarantee and just waiting for them to call me to go do my OE. But when I was finished up first officer flying, I was doing about 85 to 90 hours a month of flying.
Oh, okay. You know, I have friends that are runners, and they love to run. They run every day, but when they get to a point that they can't run, if they're sick or injured, whatever, and they don't run, they tend to say that like they just don't feel right. Their skin feels too tight for their body. Mm-hmm. Now, you haven't been in the air for a while. Is there a strange feeling? Because
I'm so used to working quite a bit. Like I said, doing 85, 90 hours a month, where most people are trying to work the minimum. So I was working quite a bit. Now to not be flying for a month at this point, it's a little different. You know, it's like, what do I do to take up my time?
I was going to ask you what you do to take up your time.
I mean, well, I was studying when I was in sim training and ground school, but now that that's all done, my wife and I are joining her side of the family going to Italy this coming week. So that'll be a fun R&R for us and just kind of relax and decompress a little bit and, you know, I'm always doing the AvGeek stuff, reading AOPA magazine or listening to podcasts and different things like that. So,
well, maybe you should think about being, you know, more of a co-host on a podcast. You know,
yeah,
like
maybe.
Yeah.
I definitely got the face for the radio. So.
No, that's good.
Definitely not TV. So,
so it's an E-175 that you're flying?
Correct. Yeah, 170, 175. So.
Yeah. So how do you find that aircraft?
Oh, I love it. It does make you super lazy, though, trying to do all the mental math calculations because we have a vertical pass portion of our navigation system. So if ATC asks us across a certain point at a certain altitude at a certain time, we can punch it in the computer box and it'll take us right there where we need to be. But, of course, garbage in, garbage out. So you got to be mindful of what you put in the flight system and monitor it. And
What about other aircraft? Do you think you'd ever end up flying other aircraft?
Not at our company. We only fly the Embraer 170, yeah. 175. I'm glad I don't fly the CRJ-200. I just, every time I've ridden it, it's just never a pleasant experience. But even in the back of the 170, 175, it's very comfortable. And sitting in the back, I'm 6'2", and if I even wear my hat, I can stand up straight in the cabin of the 170, 175. So that's kind of nice. Yeah. Whereas in the RJs, I have to kind of scrunch down and take my hat off and different things like that. But for moving on, I'd like to fly the bigger and better stuff, but that'll come in time.
Yeah, so. sure. You're young, at least relative to Micah and myself.
Yeah, that's right. True.
Everybody's young compared to relative to you and I.
Well, except for Rob.
That's true.
But tell me about the FAs a little bit, the flight attendants, in terms of how you interact with them and their, you know, their role in making the passengers comfortable and safe.
It's kind of a case by case scenario. We got some that are kind of there just collect their paycheck and do the travel benefits sort of deal, the bargain. But when you get some good flight attendants, it makes the trip a lot more enjoyable because you have people to interact with and they take care of the passengers, which makes everybody happy and you don't have any issues and things like that. But you always got to keep them in the loop as far as one of the big things companies pressing is turbulence and flight attendants getting injured from turbulence. So been a big thing of trying to brief the flight attendants on when to expect turbulence, if we get any pyre-ups from aircraft in front of us, to relay that along and help them out so they stay safe in the back. And
I always keep my seatbelt fastened, as they say, just because you never know when, you know, you're going to get slammed up into the bins overhead if you're not belted in. But obviously the flight attendants most of the time are not belted in.
Correct.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So anything that could, you know, help them avoid any kind of injury or something would be be significant. Did that come about because of incidents where?
That's the number one workforce injury, I guess, for the flight attendants is turbulence injuries. So companies kind of harped on that to bring those numbers down. So I think that's an industry wide thing as well. Not just specific to our company.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I would think so, too.
You know, another question about flight attendants on a regional carrier, and maybe one day we can get a regional flight attendant on the show, but, you know, regional pilots typically are there to working their way through, gaining their hours, you know, and to move on to larger aircraft at some time, like you're doing. Is that the case with regional flight attendants, or are they there, or are they in the past? Do you have any idea?
I've always been curious to that. I've never asked. Maybe I should, because I've known some flight attendants that have moved on to bigger, better places. I know that some that have come from big and better places and came to our regional airline. So one flight attendant I've worked with quite a bit, he actually worked for Lufthansa over in Germany for a while, and once he got too old for their... because they have an age limit on how old you could be for a flight attendant at Lufthansa, that he moved to the States and started working for us. So it goes either way with the flight attendants. But, yeah, that's a good question. I'll have to ask and report back.
Okay, well, we'll check with you next Innovations in Flight.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, Captain Craig. Well, it does have a nice ring to it, doesn't it?
It is, doesn't it?
Yeah. Thanks for coming by. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
Enjoy the day. This is always a great a great event. I'm glad that you're here.
Yeah, it's my first time here. It's busiest I've seen this Uberhazy Museum. So I'm impressed and glad all these people came out. It'll be fun to. This is probably my fourth or fifth time here. So I got a lay of the land and I'll go see my favorites and go say hi to other Av geeks out here.
Very
thanks,
good.
Max and
great
Micah.
To see you. Thanks
appreciate
so much
it.
For dropping by.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Katrina Davis has joined us. She's an admissions liaison. I always have trouble with that word. Officer of the Air Force Academy. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you. Just glad to be here.
So can I call you Katrina?
Absolutely.
All right. See, if David was here, David always, he knows the military, you know, kind of proper way of addressing. And I'm just a stupid civilian. So
you see, I have a hard time with that because you're Lieutenant Colonel. I have a really hard time not giving you all that proper respect of working your way up to become Colonel Davis. So you may call her Katrina, but I may be calling you Colonel Davis.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
That's good. It will confuse everybody. David will like you better as a result of that, I think. So what is your, you know, what is your role with the Academy? Can you describe it a little bit?
So I'm an admission liaison officer for the Air Force Academy. Essentially, I work with high school students, giving them information about the Academy, about the Air Force in general, career opportunities, educational opportunities, and I walk them through the application process from beginning to end.
So are these students that already have some interest in the Academy, or are you trying to cultivate interest when they didn't know they might have interest otherwise?
A little bit of both. At events like this, a lot of times we have a lot of young students that I'm able to talk to about the military, talk about the aircraft, talk about flying, talk about space. At an, like I said, an air and space event like this, they're very young and they're just interested in the aircraft. And so we start there and work our way up. By the time they hit high school, we talk more about academics and the requirements for application. And by the time they hit their junior year, that's when we actually start the application. By the time they actually get their appointments, we offer about 1,400 appointments per year across the world, and hoping that we'll have about 1,200 students start each year.
Hmm. So starting with the very young ones, I think that's really kind of a significant point that even though they're maybe not going to do anything today after getting some exposure to the possibilities or to airplanes, they might in the future. And there really isn't a too young age to sort of spark that interest, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Right now, I'm sitting in front of the SR-71. And so that sparks a lot of interest. And we have a lot of parents and grandparents and young children come through. So we're able to talk about that aircraft and what makes it unique, what makes it special. A lot of times when we're at air shows, that's just an opportunity for the kids to see things and touch things, just to spark that interest, like I said. And then as they get older, we start talking about other career fields. Obviously, the Air Force does a lot more than just produce pilots, but that's what catches their interest first.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I could see that. And do you have to later redirect people from thinking about being a pilot to something else, or does it sort of naturally unfold?
Right now, we are always seeking pilots. We're definitely in a shortage for pilots right now. There are always opportunities that are available. But I'm quick to tell them about all the other opportunities for careers as well. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about some of those opportunities besides being a pilot.
Sure, absolutely. Everybody thinks of the Air Force as flying aircraft. Therefore, they think of aircraft maintenance, fixing aircraft. But there's so much more than that. You have civil engineers. We need them to take care of the runways. They build the buildings. We have finance. Obviously, everybody needs to be paid if they want, you know, if they want us to keep coming back. Any position that you have in the civilian world, essentially, you're going to have a career field that mimics that in the military. Again, because we have vehicles, we have transportation, we have people fixing things. Any career, like I said, that you have in the civilian world is going to be mirrored in the military.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Micah, too, because we talk about the same thing, the same ideas within the commercial realm. So in other words, people who maybe aspire to be an airline pilot or something like that, or you know, think in those terms, but there are many, many other I hate to use the word supporting, because they're not really supporting positions, because they're equally important.
Other opportunities within aviation.
Yeah, yeah. And so while we talk about that a lot in the commercial realm, in the commercial space, the same thing is true here in military.
Yeah. And I was going to say, Colonel Davis, you've worked your rank up, Lieutenant Colonel Davis. Tell us your story. How did you end up being, you're now the liaison or admissions officer or with the Air Force Academy? How did that happen, and how did you get to where you are?
Sure, absolutely. Kind of a crazy story, because I remember when I was in seventh grade, we had to write an essay saying what I want to be when I grow up. And I said I wanted to be a fighter pilot. And my female teacher told me, absolutely not, no way, redo it, because females can't do that. That was just my motivation. So from then on out, I pushed hard. I made sure I did the best I could academically. I joined clubs. I did sports, did everything I could physically to keep myself physically fit, and applied to the
Air Force Academy, made it in. I was an economics major while I was at the academy. I had all intentions of being a pilot. I ended up getting injured while I was at the academy and lost my pilot qualification. But it was a complete blessing because I had a military advisor there who talked to me about being an aircraft maintenance officer. And I was like, I don't know about how to fix aircraft. I just know about flying aircraft. And so he encouraged me to pursue it. And I absolutely loved it because being an aircraft maintenance officer isn't about fixing the aircraft. It's more about working with the people, ensuring they've got the supplies, the time, everything that they need in order to get the job done. So therefore, as an officer, my job wasn't to fix the aircraft. My job was to work with the actual maintainers who were on the flight line on the aircraft.
And where did you do that?
So I have been around the world many, many times. I worked with B-1s, C-130s, F-16s, C-135 or KC-135s. So I've kind of had a wide range. We spent several years in Japan, which I loved. We started out in Texas. So like I said, many, many places.
And what brought, how'd you get back to the academy?
So, coming full circle, I graduated in 99, so I just hit 20 years. And so, therefore, this is an opportunity for me to still give back to the academy, reaching out to those young kids who are just starting their careers, being motivating them and giving them the information they need to start their career, hopefully be just as successful as I have been. The Air Force has been an amazing opportunity for me.
So, I changed my mind. I think I shouldn't call you Katrina. I think I should call you a colonel or lieutenant colonel. I mean, you're a lieutenant colonel, but do you get addressed as colonel?
Correct. If I'm speaking, then I'll say I'm Lieutenant Colonel Davis.
Okay. Yeah, but people...
People shorten it as...
Yeah, most people, like Jeff Falmouth. He's Lieutenant Colonel Falmouth, but we call him Colonel Falmouth. You know.
Okay, so yeah, even I'm learning something here. But the reason I said I now changed my mind is because your presence, the way you communicate, the experiences, the responsibilities, they just feel deserving of the title to me. I know it's kind of a strange thing to say.
Now you get it. Now you understand.
Now I understand why. Yeah, I guess Micah was there from the start, but it took me a minute. So I apologize, but I'll be more formal. So what's going on at the academy these days? Is today's academy the same as the academy of 10 years ago?
Everybody's going to say, oh, it was so much harder when I was there. Things change. Technology changes. Communication. The big thing that I would say, the questions I get is, what about computer technology? You know, every student has their own laptop they take to class. That's different. Do we have our cell phones? Can I call home when I want? Well, you can't always use it whenever you want, but yes, you have your cell phones once you complete basic training. I would say those are the two biggest questions that that students that are applying ask. But I would say in general, the mission there is the same. It's always been the same. We are producing officers to lead our Air Force every day, the greatest Air Force in the world.
And can you tell us a little bit about the admissions process?
So in the admissions process, we start the application the spring of your junior year. And I encourage them to start early because once they're in their senior year, they're busy, they're active in their classes and as well as just senior activities. So I encourage them to start the spring of their junior year, and then work on it throughout the summer. Essentially, you start by going to academyadmissions.com, and it's a step-by-step process. Everything is online. You have a congressional nomination that you need to seek by going through a congressman and applying through their website. You have a medical examination board. You also have a physical fitness test. And then you have several forms that just represent your SATs, your ACTs, your GPA, all that academic piece. So they take all those pieces, pull it together, and we're looking for that well-rounded person.
Tell me a little bit about the congressional recommendation, because that might sound to some people who are maybe thinking about going this path, this route, but that sounds kind of scary.
And on top of that, maybe you could explain that a bit further, because we have a lot of international listeners that may not understand exactly what that means and how important it actually is.
So in order to go to the Academy, you have to get a congressional nomination if you're a U.S. citizen. For international students that are looking to apply, that's a little bit different. You have to go through your embassy for that. So we do have international cadets that will come to the Air Force Academy. So that is a very, very unique case, and that would be something they would go through their embassy. But for those that are U.S. citizens, you have to get a nomination from your congressman. And the way to do that is to apply through their website. Some of them do face-to-face interviews. Some of them do phone interviews. Some of them just do application. But each congressman has 5 students at the academy at any time from their district or from their state. So therefore, that just helps us ensure that we have a well-represented cadet wing that represents actually what our nation represents.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Interesting.
And that admission requirement for the Air Force Academy in terms of that recommendation is no different than for the Naval Academy or the Military Academy at West Point.
That's a true statement. Almost all the information that I give is the same for across all the service academies. The application process is essentially the same. For the nomination in particular, you only have to go to one interview for your senator or for your congressman. And you tell them, my first choice is the Air Force Academy. And then, you know, maybe my second choice might be the Naval Academy. And so, therefore, they'll take that in consideration. Because, again, they only have a certain number of nominations they can give out each year.
Yeah, good. So how is the event today going for you? Are you seeing a lot of interest amongst the attendees here?
It has been very, very busy. Again, a lot of young people, but that's just fun and exciting, just giving out pictures and posters and brochures, but then also telling stories. We have a lot of grandparents that are bringing their grandkids, and so it's nice just hearing the opposite side. We have the very young kids, but then we also hear the retirees that are telling their stories, and it's just so, it's so amazing to hear both sides of it. And then, like I said, I've talked to quite a few seniors and juniors who are applying to the Air Force Academy right now as well. So right. Across the board has been amazing.
And you generally have an appearance at other at air shows, Oshkosh,
Pretty much any opportunity that we can reach out, especially if it has to do with air and space, we try to make sure we're represented there.
Yeah, great, great. Well, thank you so much. Where can folks go, a website, I'm sure, to learn more about opportunities with the Air Force?
Yes. So if you're looking to apply to the Air Force Academy, go to academyadmissions.com, and it's a step-by-step process. The website will tell you exactly what to do and how to get there.
Perfect. Well, Colonel Davis, thank you so much for spending a few minutes talking to us and our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ted Lopez is art director for Air and Space Magazine, which is an incredible publication. Ted, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're art director, and the magazine has seen some changes and some interesting and important issues lately.
Yeah, we've just redesigned the magazine the last year. We've been in a publication for over 30 years, we actually had an interesting start. We launched the month of the space shuttle disaster, the first space shuttle. And so that was a tough back in the 80s. And so that's where we started. But it's been uphill since then. I've been working on the magazine for 10 years and seen through many changes. And we've just recently redesigned it to reach a younger audience, as most publications are trying to do. And we think we're brighter, bolder colors and trying to work in, you know, strong photography and to tell the story. We recently partnered with Chad Slattery, who's a California photographer, who shot our latest cover of the D-Day flyover. It's the C-47s that right. flew to France.
Yes, yes. I saw these C-47s. They were, I'm from Connecticut.
Oh,
and they, you may know, they kind of, most of them kind of collected at the Waterbury-Oxford Airport in,
oh, I didn't
in
realize
Connecticut
that, yeah.
for a week, partly as a, you know, as a public event,
yeah.
But also I think to they did some training, some jump training, some formation flying training in advance. So I actually was fortunate enough to have a ride on the Placid Lassie.
Yeah, really?
Which was a great experience, and you might appreciate this. So I was able to take my first ever air-to-air photographs of airplanes.
It's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It is, especially bumping, you know, and around in a C-47 with, you know, no restraints, crouching next to the window, trying to, you know, to shoot out the window.
I've never been tasked with that, but I hear there's close coordination between pilots to get some great photography.
Yes, yes.
And my coworker Carolyn Sheen has been up in aircraft and been on those photo shoots, and it's really different time of day, weather. So much plays into it, and you know, I just remember them trying to get the sparklies on the water is one thing that's really desirable in a photo shoot.
And the cover shot is just really is really nice. It grabs you. It's very, you know, sort of, I don't know, graphic. And the photography in air and space is, I think, has always been pretty good.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, actually, because as the art director, you're choosing graphics, drawings, and photographs of aviation-based art things. How do you choose a photo that represents what you need to represent in terms of an aircraft or the aircraft in action? Or how do you make a decision as to what the best photo is going to be? What do you look for?
A lot of it starts from the storyline of the actual story. It's interesting because it's such a photo-driven magazine, but but if the story is compelling and the headline's compelling, that's where I start to find the right photograph that'll match and draw the readers in and get excited about the story, because we're certainly real excited. We had really fantastic writers and writing, and I don't think, you know, I think that storytelling can be through a podcast or through print still, and people will still be really enthralled by it. And we've been leading up to the Apollo, you know, the 50th anniversary. We've been just trying to look at it from different story angles rather than just the heroic story that we've all been told as kids. So, like this latest issue, we talked about why the Soviets lost the space race. I mean, they were ahead of us for so many years. Why did they lose that? They were launching, and so. But to get back to your question, sometimes we have the resources of the National Air and Space Museum and their archives, and the photo editor does a great job at finding some really hidden gems, things that have not seen the light of day, and that's what's really turned us on about the magazine, and reason why I think people keep coming back to it.
And the magazine is obviously it's associated with the museum, but it's available either as a standalone subscription or as part of the membership.
It's part of the membership to the museum, where you can get discounts on the magazine, and it's a really if you're an aviation geek,
yep.
Sorry, the title of the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
This is really
we're okay with that.
It's right. it's something that you get a window into the museum, and we hope to think that people sometimes get a back door. I mean, that's one of our selling points, is that you get a window into the museum where other people aren't going to, you know, see the strange things. We've been taking a tour of the Garber facility, which is kind of legendary. If you think of the Indiana Jones scene where they you know, hide the Ark of the Covenant, it's up in Sweetland, Maryland. That's what it's like up there. There's boxes and crates and just really strange things. So we're hoping an upcoming issue to have a bit behind the scenes tour of that. And so I think that's what we bring to the table, that other magazines are, you know, try to do, but we're able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. And just so people who are listening at home want to know, if they want to get the magazine, and boy, do we really recommend it. It's a great magazine. Yeah. You can get online and go to air and space mag.com, and for only $22 you get 7 magazines a year, and right now if you get there's a free gear bag involved, and we highly recommend it that you subscribe to
Air
and Space.
The gear bag is kind of a funny thing. I didn't think it was, like, I thought it was such a bad promo, but my boss gave me one the other day, and it's actually really functional.
It's a
there's
nice bag, yeah.
There's even inside, there's a little, there's a little cozy like lunch bag too. So it's a good deal.
That's great. That's great. Ted, thanks so much for dropping by and sticking with us and talking to us about air and space.
Yeah, good luck in the future. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ted.
Aliyah Pandolfi is back at the Air and Space Museum with your organization, the Kashmir World Foundation. And it's good to see you again. It's been a few years since we've talked to you.
It is great to see you guys as well. And you're right, it has been several years since I've seen you guys.
And we got off to a rocky start because we stole your table. I think we might have been the first, Micah, the first group in here this morning. We were in here pretty early.
We were here before they even had anybody at the door. We just walked right in.
So we strolled in, and we just kind of said, well, we'll just go back to the place where they put us every year. And we set up the table, got all this equipment put up. And after we were done with that, somebody came by from the museum and said, actually, this isn't where you are this time. So,
well, that's okay. We were late, so no big deal. We got another spot.
And
so,
the thing was, they didn't tell us who. If they would have told us it was you, we would have said, sorry, we can't take. We got to move back to where we're supposed to be.
You guys are too kind. We appreciate it. But no, I think it worked out.
It's fine. Yeah. It was great. So refresh our listeners and tell us a little bit about what's new with you and the organization since last time we've talked.
My God, I think a lot has been new since we last spoke, especially I think if we did this like 4 years ago, a lot has happened since then. We are now teaching our drone workshops internationally.
No kidding. So I remember that we came to a drone workshop somewhere around here in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
And so the idea was that students would learn, several things, including how to build a drone.
That's right. So I started, my first project with drones was really the Wildlife Conservation UAV Challenge. And I got into drones because of my passion for wildlife and finding a way to study and protect different endangered species. And then quickly I learned the lack of understanding of drones. This is early, like 2014. So I developed the DaVinci Challenge Build a Drone Workshop. And we did that for a couple of years locally here. Mm. And I had to shift back to our mission for the foundation. So we started looking into other types of drones and endangered species we wanted to work with. And I believe I spoke to you about our sea turtle project the last time we were here.
Yes.
So for that sea turtle project, we have traveled to Florida to teach our Fly for Conservation workshop. We've been to Costa Rica to teach our Fly for Conservation, Mexico. And this year, we just got back from Brazil teaching there in the Cerrado, literally landlocked in the middle of Brazil. It was fantastic, amazing, protected area. Not a wildlife project, but a tree species identification project, but using drones.
Hmm. So why is the tree identification important there?
So one of the partners we have, it is WWF is our partner in Brazil. And one of the things that they're trying to do in this protected area is look into agroforestry. And what we're trying to do is help develop a program which would allow us to maybe look at a 10-year plan. We're going to use drones to create 3D maps of the different parts of this protected area that we're working within. And part of that is to look for like fire scars and areas that have been deforested and then go back in to plant some trees. I know there's some really cool companies out there that are using drones for planting trees. We haven't committed to doing that yet. Mm-hmm. But we have committed to the AI part because that's one of the key things that we focus on is developing the artificial intelligence on board the aircrafts. So what we're starting with is being able to identify three different tree species. And we've actually already have a neural network where we can identify the palm, jelly, and the baruti tree. And the locals use those trees for harvesting the fruit. So in this agroforestry, what we're looking at is being able to take a 10-year plan, break it down into, okay, for 7 years, the locals will have this area where we're going to plant, we'll grow the trees, and then we'll get to a point where they can harvest these the fruit from the trees. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have a 3-year transition period where they're going to get out of that area that we've created for them, and we'll find another area that they're going to go into, and whatever trees have grown within that will remain for the wildlife in the park.
Ah.
And you said something earlier about, you know, going in there to find areas that have been deforested.
Yes.
And I would think that in Brazil, with such thick forest areas and such really dense, untraced populations, that there might be areas that have been deforested illegally or whatever that you wouldn't even know about and you wouldn't be able to find without the drones.
You're absolutely right. And that's why they were really excited for a couple of things, because they can cover so much ground. And I'll tell you, I mean, I was pretty surprised. We had 40 people in that training. It was amazing.
Yeah,
but one of the things that they kept saying was the fact that, you know, having the opportunity to learn how to build their drones and be able to then customize them for the future purposes is going to help them even more, because they can use the drones for other projects that they have interest in as well. Because the protected area includes like local, I think, federal and kind of like in between government authorities, because it was a hot mess. But we had groups from different government organizations that were there, and some of them were interested in tourism. We had some university professors that were interested in like mapping the caves. Oh my gosh, they had some of the most amazing, beautiful caves at this place. And they want to be able to do mapping on the outside as well as on the inside. And some of these caves are like 800 feet high, and you know, being able to map above that and have a really good idea of where it is. And then as far as like the parks themselves, they want to be able to maybe a map for the trails for the parks as well. So for search and rescue, it could be a great opportunity for them, for the tree forestry. But then our interest would always go back to an endangered species. So we're thinking about, well, you know, if we help you guys build something up, then what can we do to help the animals within this protected area as well? So we are still thinking about more ways they'll be able to use the drones besides just the one tree project.
Well, and that's something I wanted to ask you about in terms of endangered species. Recently, I think we covered a news story on the Airplane Geeks about someone that came into the country. I can't remember where he was flying in from, but had all these endangered, I think it was turtles, hidden in his pants. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the Kashmir World Foundation does is they work with animal trafficking. And can you tell us a little bit about your
Sure.
work with that and how you handle that?
So we kind of work more on the counter-poaching. So one of my goals was to get to it before they kill the animals. And the reason for that is we do have a lot of different organizations that have been working on the trafficking part. Like once they confiscate the parts, what do you do? For me, it wasn't the area that I was interested in because the animals are already dead. So I wanted to work with where can I interject where I can stop the poaching Sure. before it happens? But we do have a project with the sea turtles where we're, I don't know if you guys have come down and seen our new aircraft. It's a fixed-wing aircraft, and it's about 13-foot wingspan, and we're using that for our sea turtle project in Malaysia. So one of the challenges they face in Malaysia is the fact that there are illegal fishing pens in the ocean, and the poaching vessels will come by, and they'll take the turtles at their convenience. Huh. And with our drone, what we're doing is we're going to be able to fly around these islands, look for the illegal fishing pens, and then using AI, we could scan inside to see if we could detect the turtles. And eventually, with enough data, we'll be able to identify the turtle species that we're looking at and count the number of turtles that are found in that holding pen for that we find somewhere in the ocean that's not supposed to be there.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about the process for that data acquisition and analysis. Are the drones using optical sensors and recording video, essentially?
So that's a great question. I looked at this in many ways because the hardest part is getting that data.
Yes.
And one of the things I learned early on is, like, for example, with our project in South Africa, if we were trying to collect data on the poachers or the animals, we would have to go into the field and we'd be there for maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, right? Once a year, if that. But
I didn't want to be stuck with that situation. I wanted a pool of data from different times, different seasons, different times of the day as well. So that's one of the reasons why the Fly for Conservation workshops are so important for us, because we leave a pool of people in the countries that we teach in. They can then continue to collect the data, share that data with us, and then we can continue to develop the AI and improve the capabilities of that AI as we get new data from them. And then we can send them a software update to say, okay, this is, you know, version 3 or version 4 or version 5. And now we've gotten to the point where we were able to say, yeah, that's a turtle, to, hey, that's a loggerhead sea turtle, or that's a leatherback sea turtle. But it makes it much more efficient, because I am a nonprofit and I have to also be always conscious of how much money we're going to be spending, and cost of travel can get pretty expensive. So this way we have a trained group of biologists or researchers, or if we're working on the counter-poaching end, law enforcement groups that we work with, where they can collect data, use the drones, share that data with us, and we can continue to help improve it.
And is it, we were talking before about the tree identification,
yes,
application. Is it essentially the same kind
method
of process?
Yeah, so the method is usually the same. And another thing that, you know, I found works really well is our partnership with a conservation organization and a university. Because I feel like, you know, the generation where they're just growing into technology and programming or computer science, it's so important to help them understand the importance of animals. But then how do you use this technology to help these animals? So we partner up a lot. When we taught in Mexico, our partner, conservation partner was Pernatura, and they're working with our sea turtle project. And then our university partner was Merida University. And therefore, between the technical side of that university's capability, research students and professors, we can then have a technical team in Mexico that can help if we get into a too technical issue where the conservationists can't really figure it out. And now not only are we making our data transfer much easier, but we're also making the ability to integrate and upgrade the drone sensors and components as needed, because we have a good educational team in place as well as a conservation team.
So the fixed wing drone that gets you longer flight times, greater distances, are you using a commercially available drone, or modifying one, or building
That's
one from scratch?
Great question. Well, this is actually going to be our very own fixed wing, and it is called the Avenger. And we have been working on it for a while now, and it's actually in partnership with a friend of ours who has been working on it for a while, and then my husband Ron has been working with him on the modifications, and we finally got it together last night.
Oh.
Ah, it's here. So
congratulations.
You guys have to come by and take a look at it. It's beautiful, but there's definitely a lot of modifications we want the drone to have before we can make it commercially available as well. Like for us, it's going to be used for our conservation partners, but I think it's such a great aircraft, and the price point that it's going to be at, I think it could be used for a lot of different applications that right now we don't have that buffer zone of an aircraft that really works, where you could just snap it in and it's fully electrical and it can do 3.5 to 4 hour time with where we are right now. And then obviously with added battery power, we can increase the endurance if need be, but then that all depends on the sensors that go in as well. So I can't say exactly too much, because it is customized, but the drone would be customized for either Brazil, if we're doing the tree cover, you know, if we're covering, like, I don't know, I think it's 1,800 hectares or something like that, we can use this aircraft versus multi-copter for close combat kind of situation. So that's kind of our goal, is to be able to customize aircraft for the missions that we care about. And if it's an aircraft that actually works really well, we've been asked by so many other groups that don't do wildlife stuff if we would be willing to make it available for them to be able to purchase. And then all that funding.
Cashmere World Foundation,
yeah.
Air Force, you know, with all the different aircraft for different missions.
Yes, exactly. There's one exciting thing that we're doing this summer.
which is our Teachers Take Flight workshop, has really taken off. I had to back off on the workshops that you guys came to because it was just taking a lot of time away. But our Teachers Take Flight workshop last year was in partnership with Texas A&M University in Dallas. So we taught there. And we had 24 teachers from, I think, 8 different school districts in Dallas. That was really exciting. And this year, we've actually partnered with CapTech Consulting in Reston, Virginia. So they're hosting it for us. And the reason why this is the first time I'm partnering with like a tech company is because they want the teachers to be able to have a better understanding of the future of aviation with AI. So the company we're partnered with, that's what they do. They do artificial intelligence for their clients, cloud-based learning and mobile apps and all sorts of kinds of things that you see in a class curriculum. But then it's like, well, how is it applied? So with this company, we're able to have them come in and give some guest lectures on how AI is being used in the world of business. So when students graduate, this will give the teachers an opportunity to understand a little bit more. But then we bring in the drone aspect of it. Well, now you understand AI on its own, but how is it integrated with drones for real world applications? Because I feel like if in the 5 year, in the next 5 years, you don't have a drone with AI capabilities, you are definitely carrying around a phone as if it's like 1990 or something, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned a lot of different applications here. How are you finding new applications and new projects? How are they coming to you? Are you just things that occur to you, or people coming to you? How are you finding those?
Some of these ideas come to me because I'm usually interested in different animals, and I also research different technologies that become accessible and affordable. Because I work with conservation, I always have to think about, is this something affordable for the conservation world? And then, yes, another way is people come to us. I think, you know, now seeing drones as more common in the conservation world, we get a lot more people contacting us to say, hey, you know, well, just last night I got an email from someone in Brazil. They're like, oh, you know, we could totally understand your drone project for the sea turtles and finding the nests on the beach with the drones, because we have 65 kilometers of beach to cover every single night. And there's just no way we have enough manpower to be able to do that. So I feel like we're getting to a point where drones are becoming more acceptable and applied to real uses as well. So we get contacts from people all over the world about that. And then if I travel and I see like a need for something, then I'm like, wow, you know, this is something I'd want to be involved with. So we do have we started in South Africa with the rhino elephant poaching crisis. We transitioned to sea turtles on the conservation end, which is with the biologists, but then also expanded with the counter poaching in Malaysia. And we have the Brazil tree species project. And then we also have a snow leopard project. So you could see like the environments that we're going to be in will vary. So that's the other reason why custom drones is really the only way for us to be able to keep moving forward, pushing on the technology, integrating AI. And, you know, we have interns from all over the world. And I feel like that's what makes us successful, is a pool of driven, motivated intellects from all over the world that want to help with wildlife protection. But at the same time, they have skills in technology that now they can apply to that as well.
Sure. And you're finding that different in jurisdictions or places that you're doing this are being cooperative from a legal standpoint and letting you use your own drones and flying at night for the sea turtles and that stuff. So that it sounds like that's going well. Is that true?
Yeah. So it's not always, it doesn't always go well. It really does honestly depend on the country and our partner in that country. Because if you are an established organization in whatever country you're working in and you have a good track record from before, if you're going to propose something new as a technical advancement for your work, I think the government will support that more than if we were just going in ourselves and saying, hey, we want to come in and we're American company coming in to do XYZ, they're going to be like, no, I don't think so. But we do have some amazing partners on the ground that do all the logistics and approvals for
whether it's, you know, bringing in the drones or some transmitters. I think we needed some extra approval for Brazil, which I didn't know about. But, you know, our partner did all of how do we get the equipment into the countries.
Yeah, I would imagine that you can you have more flexibility to do things with drones in other countries than currently
yes.
here in the United States, because,
yes.
you know, we're not as far along in developing the regulations that would govern things like flying beyond visual line of sight and
yes.
night flying and things like that. So is that holding you back from some projects you might undertake in the United States, or you've just got plenty of existing projects?
I think I do have plenty of existing projects, and I feel like because we can travel, and because for me it's more important that what we're testing is in the environment we're using it in, it doesn't impact us as much as if we were only working in the U.S. and we had to abide by all those rules and regulations. So I think from that perspective, because we can do our tests outside the U.S., it makes it much easier for us to not have to deal with all the little dots and the crosses on your T's for getting through with the approvals that, you know, some places it will be impossible to fly here.
All right. Well, where can our listeners learn more about these projects, or maybe even make a donation to the foundation?
Sure. Well, they could definitely visit www.kashmirworldfoundation.org, and that's KASHMIR. worldfoundation.org. And our Teachers Take Flight workshop is from August 5th through the 8th. So they'll learn to build, program, fly their drones, but then think about what projects the students can get involved with, where it will push on bringing in computer science students into integrating, like we're always talking about STEM, but it's mostly also how do you integrate all of that together. So I think with what we do, they could see like the projects we're doing and how we're pulling from so many different areas that it makes a really good research project and hands-on project learning for students, whether they're in high school or university level as well.
Great. All right. Well, again, it's great to see you. We're nearing the end of the day here. And I hope you had a lot of good action at your table.
We did. It was pretty jam-packed today. I mean, a lot of people from outside Virginia usually.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think because what we do is so different than what they expect to see here for Innovations in Flight, they're like, please sign us up. We want to know. Or when are you going to be in our town to teach a workshop or something?
Great.
So it's nice. I think, you know, that also always helps in the long run. You never know who reaches out when and how.
Yes.
So it's been a really great day. And what about you guys? Did you guys have a lot of good interviews?
We did. And I think almost totally depleted our supply of Airplane Geeks buttons. They were a big hit apparently this year. So that's been great. But we've met some really interesting people.
Present company included.
And,
thank you.
it's just been a wonderful day.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So are you guys going to head back today? Or are you doing your
we have dinner
tonight
yep,
with the team?
At the Red Robin.
Yep. Okay.
You guys are invited. Everybody's invited. And we hope to have a great time.
Sure you will. You've got a cool team here.
Well, and let's not make it so long between visits next time.
Yeah, I agree. Let's at least not wait almost like a half decade.
Right.
Oh, boy, it sounds so long.
I know.
Yeah. Thanks
again. Imagine how I feel.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you guys so much for your time today.
Wow, what a day.
You know, you say that after this event every year because it's true. It's kind of hard to describe, you know, if you haven't been here before. I mean, you've got the ambiance of this amazing museum, the people that come by, the people you talk to, the planes you see.
Everywhere you turn around, you run into someone you didn't expect, and it's just everything's really pretty overwhelming. It's pretty fantastic.
Yes, and there are a lot of people here that you know and have seen before, or you know but have never met. you know, and it's an opportunity to do this.
Sure. I met two or three people today that I have seen on the runway at my local airport, but have never actually met face to face. And, you know, people from other podcasts and everybody's having a great time and everybody wants to talk to you.
Absolutely. That's
and then
true.
There's the whole fact of being together, of us being together. Granted, Robert, we only met you last night, but we've known you for a long time. And Max, you and I have known each other for years, but we only see each other once a year, and it's usually down here. And it's just it's a family reunion and a family gathering. And in fact, we didn't get a chance to interview her, but one of our regular listeners and good friends, Tanya Wyman, who lives in New York, unannounced and as a surprise, flew down to visit just for the day to be able to say hello to us because we haven't seen her since last year.
And she was wearing
an Airplane Geeks t-shirt.
Yes. Well, that was really cool. I tell you, that was really cool. And it was good to see her, too.
And there were three downsides of the day that I got to bring up. One was Aunt Benet wasn't here.
Yes.
And she's my aunt, and I haven't seen her in a long time. And two, David, who lives here, this is his house. He couldn't be here in his house because he's so ill, and I missed him so much because when we had some of the Air Force people here and some of the others, he's such a fountain of knowledge and so perfect on protocol, and he was just wonderful. And again, he's part of the family, and he wasn't here. And then three, I've got to say this, and I hope you're not going to be upset, and I hope if you need to cut it out, but I miss Lisa.
Oh, and, thank you, Micah.
And
thank
it's, you. Yeah. I've never been here without her, and Drone Mama, God bless you.
You're here.
And I love you, Max.
Thanks.
I'm sorry, Max.
It's okay. No, it's fine. Thank you. Thank you. Once again, I didn't get outside.
Hang on a second. I'll give you a break. But, you know, the other thing that this is for me, and I'll share with our listeners because they know these people. It's kind of hard for me to say, but I come here with my family. And my family is my mother, Harriet, who you all know, and I'm wearing her wedding ring. And my family is my father, Lou, who you all know and I've told you about, and I'm wearing his watch. And my family is my grandpa, Max, who I flew for the first time with, who I loved and adored, and who left me at 14 years old, but I'm wearing his ring. So I travel to the Udvar-Hazy Center each year to visit my Airplane Geek family, but I bring my family with me.
Nice. Very nice. Oh, I tell you, it's wonderful to be here, see you guys, and meet new friends.
It's been a lot of fun, and I have to say, you know, Micah, as you said, I've known you for some time now, but we met for the first time less than 24 hours ago, and you know, the opportunity to step in and do this with you guys has been an honor and a privilege, and I've had a great time doing it, and I certainly hope I've held up my end of the bargain, and look forward to seeing you guys again in the near future.
Yeah, it's been great to have you. I look forward to doing this again, or other events
in some form.
And
that's the beauty of podcasts. And you know, and there's another relative here with me today who we didn't get a chance to interview, and that's my Krepluck brother Eric Ryback, who we all met at Pittsburgh. But what I said in Farnborough many years ago with the airline pilot guy, and this is what I wanted to say to Robert, is that yeah, we just finally met for the first time, but the beauty of podcasts and the beauty of this media is that when you get together, I didn't just meet Robert, I met a new old friend.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up and say goodbye. We'll have show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/whatever episode this is. Let's see, 557. So airplanegeeks.com/557. We'll try to have as many links to the organizations that the people we interviewed with or are associated with, any other material that is supporting of our conversations with those folks.
And we know that we haven't had a regular guest on in quite some time, but we've got quite a few things, we don't know when, but quite a few people lined up in the pipeline, don't we, Max? Can you tell us who might be coming?
Well, I tell you one person we do have coming up. We plan to have Dick Kapinski on very soon, probably in just 2 weeks. We have a number of other folks.
We have Portland Jetport director Paul Bradbury is coming up. We've got a gentleman who has flown around the world at least twice in a single engine aircraft, either once east-west and once west to east, or once east-west and one north to south, or once west to east and once north to south. Josh Marvell should be coming on in a little bit.
And so it's a great lineup. And I think, as I mentioned last week, we have a bunch of guests, potential guests, hopeful guests in the pipeline. So we're working hard to fill that in. So we always ask if you can subscribe to this podcast. That's the best way to make sure that you don't miss any issues. Some people hear the word subscribe and say, well, how much does it cost? Well, it doesn't cost anything, of course. And you can do that in the podcasts app in iTunes. The podcast app, let's say, in iOS, the Google Podcasts app in Android. We're also on Spotin. We're also in
Spotify.
Yeah, there we go.
And yes, and remember, it's absolutely free, but you do get what you pay for.
That's right. You also find us in Pandora now. TuneIn, Stitcher, any place where you find podcasts. Look for us and subscribe. So with that, I'll ask all of you to please join us again next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Goodbye, guys. It's been a blast. Thank you very much.
And for David, thanks for listening.